From WKAR's Studio S at Michigan State University, this is Current Sports.
Hello and welcome to Current Sports on this beautiful Thursday afternoon. My name is Matt Ludke. I am filling in for Al Martin, at least for the next few minutes. He is actually downstairs interviewing Spartan legend Steve Smith. And when Steve Smith is in the building, you make exceptions. So he's going to be down there interviewing him for the Current Sports TV show. He'll be back up in a little bit. Now, he and I have a little bit of Darko Milicic to talk about later in the show. We'll get to that. I have pages and pages and pages of notes. But first, Al had a chance to catch up with Yahoo senior investigative reporter Charles Robinson. He chatted with him earlier today and asked him how he got his start in journalism here at MSU.
I transferred into Michigan State. I actually went to Grand Rapids Community College. I knew I wanted to be a reporter. I wanted to be a journalist. I thought I wanted to be a columnist. I came to Michigan State because it had a J school that was, you know, fairly well recognized. The State News was, I think at that time, was the largest student newspaper in the country. And I thought, where do I want to go? You know, I want to go someplace that's recognized and, you know, has the largest number of students reading, you know, the newspaper. And so I ended up in it would have been 96. I came to Michigan State and got an internship at the State News and thought I wanted to be a columnist, but quickly learned that, you know, I really enjoyed news reporting. I really enjoyed kind of the process of digging, digging out information. And, one thing led to another. And over my time at Michigan State, I slowly kind of morphed into a sports/news reporter. And, once I graduated Michigan State, I didn't graduate with the thought of, hey, Michigan State has taught me that I want to be an investigative sports reporter. Mm-hmm. It just taught me that I loved being a journalist. You know, I loved digging. That was really my life's passion. And, once I got an internship at the Free Press, I ended up spending 6 months at the Free Press in Detroit, got my first job at the Oakland Press. Things kind of, one thing led to another. I bounced around the country a little bit, ended up at Yahoo, and lo and behold, about 4 years ago, we established the investigative beat at Yahoo Sports.
Wow, I'm pretty sure you had a huge hand in that, Charles. Now, Charles, for you, you talk about, you know, being at the State News and being, you know, that news/sports reporter. Did you ever do any investigative pieces for that combined sports and investigative reporting while at the State News?
Yeah, we did. We actually did. We did. Let's see, what ones stick out in my mind? I remember the NCAA used to put out this book, big, thick book, thousands of pages, called the Graduation Rates Report. And what it did, it talked about, you know, it was all about football programs, and it talked about standardized testing scores, things of this nature. And
right.
I remember I asked the State News if I could spend $40 of the budget to buy this, which was a big deal at that time. You're spending $40, you're not going on a trip.
Right, right.
So I remember I got the book mailed to me, and I literally spent, I think it was like 2 weeks, sitting there and paging through this. It was like 1,500 pages, and essentially putting into a spreadsheet the standardized scores of Michigan of football players coming into their programs. When I got to the end of it, I realized that Michigan State had like, their standardized test scores were 119th out of like 120 Division I football programs, which was a stunner. Like,
yeah,
it was a shock.
Is.
I couldn't believe it. And so, you know, I delved into it, ended up doing kind of a 2-day investigative report. And, I remember Nick Saban at that time was the coach, and he refused to comment. And, we ran the report, and I remember the day after the report initially ran, the first day, I got a call. And it was John Lewandowski, who's still the sports SID here. And he said, look, Charles, it's Nick Saban's on the line. He wants to talk to you. And he says, let me just give you a piece of advice. He said, just let him say what he's got to say. And I thought, this is not going to be a positive phone call.
Right, right.
And he did. He put Nick on. And at that point, when the report ran, the Associated Press picked it up. All the wires picked it up. It was on, like, local news. So it became kind of big news. And so Nick gets on the phone, and I mean, for a good 5 minutes, I mean, he just ripped me. I mean, he was all over me. He was really upset. And, you know, I just kept saying to him, like, Nick, you know, I gave you an opportunity to talk about this. I wanted to talk to you. You know, you said no. And we kind of went through that sort of, went through that dance. And eventually he got over it. He left for LSU. So I wasn't.
Yeah, eventually, right?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't on the spit for too long with Nick Saban. He wasn't long for Michigan State at that point. But I think that was probably one of the first, in terms of sports investigative stories. But I think every beat I was on at the State News, you know, I found, you know, something interesting to write about that maybe people didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think that's probably when I started to learn at Michigan State that, hey, this is what I do. This is what I enjoy. I like to find maybe little wrinkles that people don't know about.
Well, not everybody can say that they got ripped by Nick Saban. That's a pretty cool story.
And
right
Tom
there.
Izzo. I think.
And Tom Izzo,
yeah,
too.
Oh, yeah. Tom got around to me eventually.
Really? What happened with that one?
Oh, boy. You know, I had written, there were a few times with Tom, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
I think the one that was probably the worst, you know, we had a Michigan State had recruited a player out of junior college, and he kind of had a two-year hole sort of in his life where he would have been in high school, but no one could really explain what had happened to him during this two-year period of his life. He was from the south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, I reached out to some people, and they said, you know, yeah, you know, it's kind of weird. He may have sold some drugs. You know, he was in high school. He had some friends that weren't the greatest people. We're not sure. We never really pushed him that hard on the point. So I met with this player, and I said, you know, look, I said, the situation is this. You want to become an NBA player. You told me that. You wanted to be a first-round pick and all this. I said, if you're going to achieve that, a lot of people are going to look at you. They're going to look at your background. They're going to write stories about you. And eventually someone's going to come across this two-year period, and they're not going to take the time with you to understand what happened in that two-year period.
Right.
And I said, I'm offering you the opportunity. I had a whole summer at that point to spend on this and to understand what happened to those 2 years, because I kind of figured it was something that, you know, probably wasn't exactly palatable from his own standpoint, something he didn't want to talk about.
Right.
And, you know, I gave him a couple of days to think about it. We talked again. He said, yeah, you know, I'm ready to talk to you about it. And so I spent literally months delving into this two-year period where he had dropped out of high school and, you know, he had sold drugs for a while. And, you know, he got caught up with the wrong set kind of at that point in his
wrong
life.
Crowd, right.
But it really was a story of redemption because he turned his entire life around. You know, he ended up going back to school. He ended up making up 2 years of school literally in a year and a half's time.
Wow.
And he dug himself out of a situation that he just one day decided he didn't want to be in this. He had friends who died, you know, some friends who went to prison. It was just a situation where he looked at it and he said, this just isn't what I want. You know, I want something else. And so it really was a story of redemption.
So it was a feel-good story.
It was. But the problem was I hadn't really made Michigan State aware of exactly what it was until the last minute, because I was afraid that there was a chance that they might try to stop, you know, this me from essentially getting the information I needed from being able to really get to the depths of this story.
And during this time, Charles, are you still at State News? Where are you at right now?
No, at this point, I had graduated. After my stint at the Free Press, I went to the Oakland Press, and I was covering the Lions and Michigan State basketball.
Okay,
so I was a year out of college.
Right.
And you know, and so they were understandably upset. They had a right to be, because I did withhold information from Tom Izzo, the coaching staff, for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the initial reaction was really blowback. Like, you know, we didn't know some of these things. Why wouldn't you tell us this? We can't believe this. You know, you're exploiting him. They were really upset. But it was a 3-day series, and by the time the third day had run, I think you saw most people looked at this and thought, man, what a good story. Like,
right. This
was really a guy who went through trials and tribulations that almost no one goes through. And he found a way to turn himself around and found a way to focus his life in another direction. And it was really kind of inspirational. But, yeah, Tom was not pleased. And
so did you get a phone call from
Tom?
We
had a few phone calls where he was pretty upset. And, you know, like I said, rightfully so. Mm-hmm. You know, I did withhold it for quite a while, and I could understand that. But, you know, as reporters, that's kind of what you go through. Sometimes you have a relationship where it's difficult. And to be fair to Tom Izzo, I will say this, he has a well-deserved reputation of probably being one of the best college basketball coaches in the country.
Hall of Famer, without a doubt. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're just now joining us here on Current Sports, we are chatting with Charles Robinson, the senior investigative reporter for Yahoo Sports. Now, Charles, you being here on campus, I mean, getting a chance, you know, you went to Michigan State, graduated from Michigan State, are doing very well, a very successful reporter over at Yahoo now, and get a chance to talk to students who, like you said, we talked before we hit the air just now, and you talk about how this is kind of, you know, it's invigorating for you, because you come back and see these hungry students who want to get into the industry, and it kind of takes you back to when you were a young reporter aspiring to do the same thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you sit there and you listen to the questions and you have these moments where you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. I remember feeling like that, or I remember wondering what that was like. And it's as much as it's for them. The truth is, selfishly, we get a lot out of it, too, because you get taken back to a place and time in your life when you were so hungry mm-hmm. and so energetic, and you know, everything was new to you, and you were going to fail so many times, but you didn't know it yet. And so, yeah, it's really a great experience to be able to reach out to students, maybe give them some tips. And the truth is, I got where I was because I was 19 and I asked a professional journalist a question. I remember it was a guy named Mike McGraw at the Kansas City Star, and I asked him, I said, you know, what's the best piece of advice you could give me? He told me, become a news reporter. You know, it's easier to make a great sports reporter, entertainment reporter, whatever, out of a great news reporter than anything else. And it was that piece of advice that kind of steered me in the right direction. So maybe I give someone a piece of advice that really helps them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what kind of questions have students been asking you about the industry, and what have you told them?
You know, a lot of questions about, you know, when you were at Michigan State, did you ever perceive that, you know, you would end up at a place like Yahoo? Which, you know, at that time, I remember I was at Michigan State, I barely knew what Google was. I graduated in 2000, but remember, this is 97, 98, we're just starting to use Google, and I'm like, I don't know what this is. And, you know, Yahoo at that time was not really a media company, it was not into media, so you didn't really, that wasn't something that you looked at. But, you know, questions like that, things like, how do you handle difficult situations, like when a coach confronts you and you have a blow up? How do you get over that? Maybe when you have to cover a tragedy, how do you deal in an you know, in a really sympathetic, empathetic way with the individuals who you have to actually still try to get information from them? So and how to get a job?
That's very true too.
Everybody wants to know how to get a job. So it's a lot of the same questions that I think I had at that time. But I admire students now more than ever, because the truth is, I didn't have nearly as much stuff to deal with as they do now. When you consider Twitter, all this explosion of media now. Back then, it was just, hey, you went to work for newspapers, you know, and it was like a coal mining town. Everybody worked in the coal mine.
Right.
Now, there's just so many opportunities, you know, for people, but that's kind of daunting too.
That is very, very true. Twitter kind of almost in a way makes everybody a reporter now. It's so crazy. Now, for you, Charles, just talking about the field of sports investigative reporting, how has it kind of evolved from, you know, you talk about back in the 90s. How has it evolved from the 90s to where it is now in 2014?
It's, you know, it's faster. You talk about Twitter. Twitter is a great example of how much the news industry has changed, because when I was at Michigan State, we had what was called a 24-hour news cycle. You literally would have a whole day to write a story, and it wasn't going to come out until the next day's paper. You know, as long as television reporters didn't find out about it, it wasn't going to be on the 6 o'clock or 11 o'clock news.
Right.
So you kind of had a whole day. But now with Twitter, it's second by second. You know, information can leak at any time and become news instantly. And like you said, it doesn't have to be from reporters. It doesn't have to be from anybody. Anybody can become a reporter. So in a way, that has made sports investigations and really just investigative journalism that much more difficult, because you really have to go on a deep dive. And what I mean by that is you have to get deep into a subject without other people finding out. Because people will go on Twitter and they'll talk about, hey, Charles Robinson showed up at my door today and he was asking X, and your cover's blown. Or, you know, I had literally a moment where we were working on a Syracuse basketball investigation, and Pat Forty, who works at Yahoo Sports, formerly worked at ESPN, very recognizable face. We had stopped, and we were going to the Syracuse archives. We got out of the car. No one recognizes me. I mean, I've done some television work, but not like Pat. Pat was on TV like every day for ESPN. Mm-hmm. We get out of the car, and it was in front of like a fraternity house. And literally, there's a guy standing on the porch, and he says, "Hey, that's Pat Forty." And we're supposed to be undercover here. And I'm like, "Pat, like, I can't bring you anywhere. People notice you, recognize you. Like, this is ridiculous. This guy's going to go on Twitter. People are going to be like, why is Pat in Syracuse?" So, you know, it has challenges now in terms of trying to hold that kind of bubble that you're in as long as you possibly can without anybody finding out. So it's
you're going to be like, let's say like 007, 007 agent.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it really is. I mean, it's, you know, you definitely don't want to broadcast where started using Twitter, but when I really started getting into investigations, I remember one of the first investigations I did was in Lawrence, Kansas. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was tweeting something, and one of my followers said, "What are you doing in Lawrence, Kansas?" And I thought, how does this guy know I'm in Lawrence, Kansas right now? And someone said to me, "Well, you know, there's a locator tag."
Oh,
I know
you put
account.
The locator tag
and
on.
I didn't realize that it was on. And so I'm like, oh, my God, I got to turn this thing off. And so all these people are like, "Why are you in Lawrence?" Because at that point they had known, you know, that I was doing investigative work. We had gone through the whole sort of process with USC We'd done a lot of reporting on the USC football program. So I turned it off, but then you kind of endure it for a couple of days where people are like, why were you in Lawrence? What's going on in Lawrence? You haven't written anything about Lawrence, so what were you doing there?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you kind of, technology has made the job a little more challenging, but you do have to, it is kind of like a 007 job. You don't want to tell anybody anything.
No, not at all. Now, and for you, Charles, something that fascinates me, whenever I see an investigative piece done in the sports world, I mean, there's a ton of groundwork that has to be done. I mean, getting people to talk and open up about very touchy subjects and diving into statistics and numbers and understanding the legal system. I mean, for you, Charles, how do you go about, first of all, finding an investigative story to write about, and then second, attacking it when it has so many angles to it?
Right. There's so much process that you don't know exists until you've gone through it a few times. And, you know, for me, it starts like anything. I mean, you have sources out there, or you make introductions to people. You just listen. And whether it's a hardened source you've had for a long time, whether it's someone new that you meet, whether it's, you know, someone on Twitter will reach out to you and just say, hey, you know, I know something. It's you always listen. And then that's where stories kind of develop. For me personally, I'll always have 9 or 10 irons in the fire, but you always are looking for that one that takes precedence, the one that's most available to develop, the one that you're making the most progress on. Believe me, I've had a lot of investigative stories fail, and you never hear about those because you get halfway down the line. Something happens. Mm-hmm. Somebody falls through. They turn out not to be credible. Some documents don't come through. And next thing you know, you've spent all this time on something that is dead for all intents and purposes.
Right.
So you kind of go through that. But when you find something that you can hook onto and that really is promising and develops, like you said, just a lot of groundwork. You talk to a lot of people. You gather as much documentation, evidence, interviews, and you take this mass of information, you try to sharpen it down into the best report you can, and then, you know, you hand it over to lawyers who sit there and go, this can get us sued, that can get us sued, this can get us sued.
So they go through that process of what can happen if this goes out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we go through a very heavy vetting process at Yahoo where, you know, lawyers literally pick through every vowel, every consonant of your story and try to pick things apart. And it's hard to go through that the first few times, but then after a while, you kind of build up an understanding of what that relationship is and how to deal with it. And, you know, but that's sort of the whole process of it. It lives and it dies. And there are a lot of things in between that you sort of have to deal with. And then you move on to the next one.
Wow. Intricate to say the least. I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, again, if you're just now joining us here on Current Sports, we're talking with Charles Robinson. He is the senior investigative reporter for Yahoo Sports. Now, Charles, before I get you out of here and get back to talking to students and whatnot, speaking of Twitter, I was on your Twitter and you're actually, I believe you were at Pro Day for the Johnny Manziel thing. You know, we talked about it here on Current Sports. It looked, from what I saw, a complete fiasco. Media everywhere, rap music. I think he was banging some Drake before we went out there, and he addressed the media. Unlike anything I've ever seen. Was it unlike anything you would ever cover?
Yeah, it was different. And, you know, I covered the NFL nationally for almost 10 years up until I took over the investigative beat for a few different outlets. And I don't think I've ever been to a pro day where you saw a former president, George Bush, and his wife, Barbara, showed up, where you had, like you said, Drake, Kanye, you know, pumping out of speakers while they're actually going through the drills, which was really interesting. The number of media that showed up, I mean, the spectacle of it was definitely different than anything I'd ever seen before. But you know what? That's also kind of who Johnny Manziel is. It was accurate to the representation of what comes with that package, and there's a lot of good to that, and there's some, you know, what people would perceive as potential negatives, but, you know, times change. And I think what's interesting to me is when you talk about a guy like that, you talk about the unionization potentially of athletes, when you talk about, you know, athletes who are now having more of a voice and trying to have more control over their lives as student athletes, you see people like Johnny Manziel and others who come through and they change it. They change the system. They change the way things are perceived. And something, we talk about all the sort of kind of craziness of what happened in that, but Johnny Manziel wore shoulder pads and a helmet for the first time anyone had ever seen a quarterback go through his pro day wearing shoulder pads and a helmet. And I'm telling you right now, having covered the NFL, going forward, they're going to look at other prospects and say, how come, why not wear shoulder pads and a helmet in yours?
Yeah.
Johnny did it. Why not? It's a little more difficult, but hey, you play in shoulder pads and a helmet. Let's see, you know, how you perform at your pro day. So,
He performed pretty well, too.
He did. Yeah. He did. You know, I mean, I think he showed people what they needed to see, and both kind of on the field and off. And, you know, it's he's one of those individuals that kind of changes perception a little bit, and he's not afraid to be, you know, that kind of guy. And it kind of makes it exciting for us. You know, it's fun to cover people who are willing to, you know, either be flawed or famous or whatever, a little bit, as well as successful as they are on the
field. I can only imagine how that fiasco was. Now, before we wrap up here, Charles, something that's really touching around this area, of course, I'm sure you've heard about it. Of course, Lacey Holdsworth, her passing yesterday morning. She was so close to senior center Adrian Payne, who in turn, of course, she became close to and kind of a staple for the MSU men's basketball program. I mean, this story was so touching. And it impacted not only Spartan Nation here, but it went national.
Right.
And the impact that it had, I mean, really, was certainly amazing. For you, I mean, being you know, with Yahoo Sports and you know, seeing a story like that just go up and blow up national. I mean, what was the national scene like in the national perception of this story? And what were your thoughts when you heard about it?
You know, I think it's touching, you know, to see that relationship. And it wasn't just what was written about it. It's to see a lot of the pictures and to see, you know, there are times where, you know, you'll read a story, but then you see a picture and you can kind of see love in a photo. You know, you can kind of see a bond and a relationship. And, you know, it's unfortunate because I think sometimes, particularly we as the media, can jump on stories and in a way exploit whether it's, you know, children who may be sick or a tragedy or things like that. I never felt like this was anything exploitive. I thought it was something that was fairly genuine. You know, it's nice because it sort of gives your readers and your audience a chance to know that, hey, college basketball players have these lives beyond the court, and they develop relationships with individuals who you may never know about. I'm sure there are other Lacys that we've never met, we've never read about, we've never seen the photos. But it gives you another window into the athletes who you cheer for, whether it's on the court or on the field. It gives you a more personal window into sort of that person's character, who they are. And I think it was touching for a lot of people. And, you know, Tom Izzo, I think, kind of put it best where, you know, he talked about how it gives perspective to life and how crushed everyone was to see MSU lose to UConn. And even UConn goes on to win the national championship, take some solace in that. But then this happens and you say, you know, there's so much more to maybe sports than what we always find. And it puts some things in perspective. And frankly, it was a very good moment, I felt like, for Michigan State and Michigan State students. When you talk about the rock being painted.
Oh, yeah, it was unbelievable.
It was. I was proud to have my alma mater represented in that way by students in sort of their outpouring of sort of emotion. And it was a good day to be a Spartan on a very somber day.
Yes, that is so true. And, yeah, you talk about that moment last night. All the students who came out next, you got a chance to paint the rock and sign the rock. And Tom Izzo and Adrian Payne addressed everyone that came there. And Tom even got choked up a little bit. I mean, it was certainly a touching moment. Charles, I want to say thank you for joining us here on Current Sports and talking about it. And, of course, your position at Yahoo Sports. Continued success, my brother. I see you later on today, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm happy to arm all these kids with the skills it takes to steal my job in 10 years.
There you go. That's why we're here, baby. Charles Robinson, senior investigative reporter for Yahoo Sports.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. A picture is worth 1,000 words, which is more than 140 characters.
People engage much more with a tweet that has a picture in it. That means they favorite it, they reply to it, they retweet it.
So it's no wonder Twitter is starting to look more like Instagram. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
That's Here and Now, coming up at 2 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Brad Walker, your afternoon host for All Things Considered on WKAR. I've always felt hosting ATC is like being a head chef in a restaurant. You always need to find the right ingredients to make a great dish. You start out with your main course of NPR, throw in a little spice with some White House drama, a pinch of Michigan news, a dash of local news, and you have the perfect recipe for a news feast. All Things Considered, weekday afternoons at 4 on WKAR.
Happy cooking.
Welcome back to Current Sports, ladies and gents. I am your host, Al Martin. Yes, I am back from downstairs. You know what, Matt? Steve Smith is one busy, busy brother. I'm pretty sure he is on one crazy schedule each and every day. We tried to get him on Current Sports TV, but his flight landed at 10:20 this morning. Then he had to go to check in at the hotel. And then I'm sure he had to go get pretty and throw on a suit and some makeup and then come back down here. So I believe he just got here at the Kind Arts building, but we didn't get a chance to sit down with him for Current Sports TV. A bit of a bummer, but we'll be seeing him later on at the panel. So
a bit of a bummer. You know, people think being a big deal is easy. It is not easy.
No.
That sounds like a hectic, hectic day-to-day life.
Oh, boy. It is, man. Being Steve Smith, I tell you. But, yeah, Steve Smith, he will be joining me to sit down one-on-one later on today right here at the Communication Arts and Sciences Building as he will host an interesting panel discussion, which you just heard. Charles Robinson, who's the senior investigative reporter for Yahoo Sports, he will be joining that panel along with other journalists who have covered the Olympics in the past few years. Steve Smith will host that panel, but before that, I will sit down with Steve to talk about his Olympic experience. Again, if you want to be a part of this very, very cool event, which will be taking place at 4 o'clock later on today, again, here at the Communication Arts and Sciences Building. I don't know if there's still tickets left, but you can do so by checking on WKAR.org. I know that those tickets were going like hotcakes, and we do have capacity. I don't know what that number of capacity is, but overflow will be present with our Current Sports bleachers as well. So there may be a few spots left to meet Steve and to meet these other journalists who will be sitting on the panel to talk about the Olympics. It should be a great evening. I can't wait for it. Again, you can go to WKR.org to see if seats are still available. Well, all right. Well, let's go to our second segment of the show. Usually it's our first, where we update you on the latest sports headliners that are taking place in the world of sports. So here are your Current Sports Quick Hit headliners for this April 10th, 2014. Okay, the Red Wings, they suffered another overtime loss in Pittsburgh last night, but notched the one-point win they needed to clinch a playoff spot for the 23rd consecutive season. How about that? This incredible streak keeps on keeping on. Now, Jesse Joykin, he scored the lone shootout goal to give the Pens a 4-3 win, but Riley Sheehan's tying goal with less than 2 minutes left in the third may have been more important. The Wings are tied with Columbus in the wild card standings, but both clubs have clinched spots in the postseason. That's great stuff there. And the Tigers, they earn a 1-1 split in their series with the Dodgers after Victor Martinez's solo homer gave them a 7-6 win in 10 innings up in the wee hours of late last night. Now, Martinez rescued closer Joe Nathan, who had blown his second save after allowing 3 runs in the ninth. Now, the Tigers will have the day off today before heading to San Diego for a 3-game series on Friday. And the Lugnuts churned out 11 hits en route to a 6-4 W over the Quad Cities River Bandits, their second in just as many days. Now, Mitch Nay's 2-run double in the bottom of the first erased a 2-0 Quad Cities lead, and the Luggies led 5-2 after 3 innings. Now, Scott Silverman, he pitched the 8th and 9th to pick up his first save of the season, and the Lugnuts will look to sweep the River Bandits tonight, Thursday at 7:05 p.m. down at Cooley Law School Stadium. Drink responsibly, folks. All right, the Pistons downward spiral continued last night with a 122-100 loss to the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cavs led by 32 at the half. Ah, it just hurt me to say that. And dominated the Pistons from the get-go. Deion Walters led Cleveland with 22 points, and the Cavs recorded a franchise record 26 assists in the first half, finishing a whopping 41. My goodness. Now, the Pistons' next matchup comes Friday night in Chicago to take on the Bulls. Pistons fans, just bear with it. The Pistons season will be over very soon. Okay, the 2014 Masters teed off this morning at Augusta. Gotta love this. I love the Masters tournament of course, Augusta, Georgia. With Tiger Woods not in the field, the golf world is hoping that most will tune in to see if Adam Scott can become the fourth player to win 2 straight green jackets, joining Woods, Jack Nicklaus, and Nick Faldo. Here's a leaderboard update for you all. Right now, Miguel Jimenez, he's 3-under tied with Brant Snedeker. Adam Scott is also 3-under, so we have a 3-way tie right now. So Scott is looking pretty good to possibly make history there. And Kevin Stadler, he's 2-under with Jonas Blinks, 2-under. So there we have that. I'm sorry, Aaron. Scott is now 4-under right now. Scott is actually 4. Is he leading the field right now, Aaron? Adam Scott is looking, sitting pretty right now. Adam Scott is 4-under leading the field. So he's looking, he's sitting well right now to possibly win 2 straight green jackets. I certainly will be tuning in. And later on today's Current Sports, if you want to call in and weigh in on this, the absence of Tiger Woods, of course, I mean, his absence is unlike any other athletes in the world of sports. We'll be talking about Tiger Woods' absence in golf and just the impact it has in the overall sport, and we'll compare it to a few other sports and other superstars. So we'll be talking about that. Should be an interesting discussion. You can weigh in on it by calling 517-355-9527. And also, Adrian Peterson, of course, Minnesota Vikings running back and former Oklahoma star, he spoke out about collegiate athlete compensation yesterday, now arguing in favor of paying college athletes. Now, Peterson stressed the amount of revenue college stars generate for their university, saying, quote, "Johnny Manziel made Texas A&M so much money. When I was at Oklahoma, they made so much money." Now, he also cited increased responsibilities that can spring up during one's college career. He also went on to say this, quote, "Nobody wants to live in the dorms for 4 years. You see the guys who are older and they have responsibilities. I feel like as much money as universities make, some of that should come down to the players as well." Now, this is said from, again, Adrian Peterson, whose first daughter was born during his time at Oklahoma. So there you have that. AP sticking up for the players and believes that they should get some type of compensation. And this is pretty interesting. Athlon Sports released rankings of the 128 NCAA Division I-A college football coaches. And the Big Ten is well represented, folks. Ohio State's Urban Meyer, he finished number 2 overall behind only Alabama's Nick Saban. MSU's Mark D'Antonio, fresh off his best season with the Spartans, he is ranked 8th and 2nd in the conference. How about that? And Brady Hoke, who as recently as 2012 was ranked 12th in the country, he has fallen all the way to 38, folks, after going 15-11 the past 2 years. Hoke is the 8th highest ranked coach in the Big Ten. And, you know, I'd have to, when it comes to this story, I have to give a shout out to all the students out there listening who attended last night's candlelight vigil in honor of Lacey Holdsworth, again, the 8-year-old cancer stricken girl who was, of course, such an impact to so many, not even just to Adrian Payne, not just the MSU men's basketball team, not just to Spartan Nation, but to this entire U.S. of A. This story really took headway and touched a lot of lives, and over 100 students joined Tom Izzo and members of the MSU basketball team in painting the rock in honor of Lacey Holdsworth, again, who passed away. Izzo and Adrian Payne both had brief statements for the crowd, thanking them for their support through this very, very tough time. Payne went on to say, quote, "You don't know how much this means to me and her family. Now, a memorial for Lacey has been scheduled for April 17th at the Breslin Center." It was really cool. There's video everywhere of that ceremony last night. You can also hear as Tom Izzo addressed the crowd and even had a moment where he actually almost choked up. It was very, very touching stuff. And so many people signed the rock and expressed their deeper sorrow for the loss of Lacey, including Tom Izzo and Adrian Payne. So that was a touching moment last night. All right, well, those are your current sports quick hit headliners. If you want to call in and share your thoughts on any of those, you know the number, 517-355-9527. Again, that's 517-355-9527. You can also go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/currentsports and even tweet me at Al Martin, WKAR. Okay, well, let's transition to our second portion of the show. And you know what? Yesterday, we had such a great conversation with Richard Kincaid, author and sports broadcaster. And, you know, we talked about Lacey yesterday, too, and dedicated a good portion of the show to that as well, that we didn't really get to our Barbershop Wednesday topic. So we're going to do that briefly today. I guess you can call it Barbershop Thursday, folks. And that question that we're really diving into, of course, with the news this week of Joe Dumars possibly stepping down as the Pistons president of basketball operations. We decided on Tuesday to take a look at the top 5 worst moves in the tenure of Joe Dumars as he's been the president of basketball operations with the Detroit Pistons. And that kind of sparked an interesting conversation with Matt, Alex, and I. And we decided to make this week's Barbershop Wednesday topic centered on Dumars, and we had to ask, because we had a little debate about this on Tuesday, was drafting Darko Milicic the worst move in Dumars' tenure? That's the question we're posing right now on today's show, and we're asking you to call in and give your thoughts on it. Was drafting Darko Milicic, we all remember that year's class, was it the worst move in Dumars' tenure? Now, if you tuned in on Tuesday as we had our top five segment on the top five worst moves in Joe Dumars' tenure, Alex and I both had number one as the Darko Milicic drafting, as Matt chose to make it honorable mention. So, again, we're making that our barbershop Thursday today. Again, you can call in and give your thoughts on it, 517-355-9527. Well, let's talk about it. Matt, I'll let you leave the floor first. Again, on Tuesday, again, I keep stressing, you had him as your honorable mention. And, you know, as I did a little research on this topic in preparation for yesterday's discussion, you had a few points that were definitely valid, without a doubt. But I'll let you take the floor, and I'll kind of rebuttal it, because I do believe it needs to be at number one, and I'll give you my reasons just a sec. Go ahead.
Okay, well, first of all, I think history will forever paint this as the worst move of his tenure. I think just the fact that, you know, behind him, you know, Carmelo Anthony, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh go off the board. You know, those are three guys who win titles, probably going to be Hall of Famers all around. So it's tough, and Darko's already out of the league. So in terms of hindsight and looking at, you know, the legacy, it's probably going to be his worst move of all time. But I think at the time, I don't think you can put it all on Joe Dumars for drafting Darko. I think you look around the league, you look at quotes from that time, Darko Milicic was the consensus number two pick before that season even ended. Mm. People were penciling LeBron in at number one, and Darko at number two. Carmelo came along in the NCAA tournament when he led Syracuse to the national championship. That's when his name skyrocketed up draft boards. He had a great freshman year, obviously. You know, gets Jim Boeheim his first title. He becomes the number three pick. But if you look around the league, I mean, people were pegging Darko as maybe being better than LeBron. I have quotes here from an SI article back in 2003. One scout counted at least 10 times that James failed to get back on defense, added one GM. You have to worry that his sense of entitlement is so great after being spoiled by the AAU system, the agents, and all the publicity. Mm-hmm. They go on to say there are no such worries about the potential number two pick Darko Milicic of Yugoslavia, who sleeps on a pullout bed, is warmed by a space heater, and earns approximately $20,000 for his small European club. He's a 7-foot left-hander with size 18 feet who can do it all. Mm-hmm. Score inside and outside, run the floor, pass, and block shots. So it's not like they were alone in thinking, wow, this guy is a can't-miss prospect. Everybody thought he was a can't-miss prospect. Will Robinson, a Piston scout for 28 years, told Chad Ford of ESPN, about one-fifth of the people in the league I've spoken to feel that Milicic will be a better player than LeBron James down the road. They prefer Darko because of his toughness, his competitiveness, and the way he moved for a guy his size. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was laughing to myself. He's going to be a much better player in the NBA because over there in Europe, he plays in a very structured, restrictive system. A lot of the guys who love Darko think he's going to be a 2 to 3 year project because he needs to develop a back-to-the-basket game. But I'm guessing he'll gain 15 pounds and be productive as a rookie.
And hold on. Who said this again, Matt?
This is Will Robinson.
Will Robinson.
Who was a Piston scout for 28 years and happened to be the guy who discovered Joe Dumars and Dennis Rodman.
And wow. So,
why wouldn't you be listening to the guy who discovered you and brought you on board?
And he went on to say that Darko will be better than LeBron?
Better than LeBron down the road.
Oh, my gosh.
He said he's going to own the game. Own the game.
Wow.
We're going to have to build a new arena. The only thing that could destroy a kid like that is a woman. That is what he said in reference to Darko Milicic.
Oh, no. That's insane. So basically, I definitely see what you're going with this. There were so many out there. And this is the point I have to make, because when we talked about this Tuesday and you brought this up, I mean, diving into just kind of the reporting and the opinions that kind of floated around the NBA world, there were a lot of people out there thinking that Darko was going to be the second coming of Michael Jordan or something like that. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, when I look at this move, though, and looking at that entire period, I think Joe D, he definitely jumped the gun a lot and kind of fed this fire to the point. I mean, when the draft approached and the whole hype about LeBron, and, you know, of course LeBron was going to go number one overall. So let's put that to bed. I mean, LeBron was the best player. He was the biggest prospect coming. I mean, the hype around him was crazy. And I remember Darko actually being, because I used to be a big Slam magazine reader back in high school, and Darko graced the cover of Slam magazine the month before, I believe it was in May, the month before the NBA draft. And I'm sitting there like, wow, this kid might be the truth. I was even sipping the Kool-Aid, you know? And the big consensus around the Pistons organization, first of all, it was a miracle that they even got that high of a pick. I mean, first of all, I don't even think Joe Dumars was even at the lottery present. You know how they, you know, pick the balls out of the big old tube? Joe Dumars wasn't even there to represent the team. I mean, that's how crazy this whole notion of the Pistons getting the second pick was. I mean, Joe Dumars didn't even think they were going to get it. I mean, it was so nuts. And when it happened, you know, Joe Dumars, this is why I say it was the worst move in his career, because of how it happened. He jumped the gun so early on this, Matt, that even though there were all this talks about, you know, of course, about, you know, Carmelo, and just looking at that class, you know, you're talking about Wade and Carmelo Anthony and Chris Bosh. I mean, there were so many people that came out that class, a lot of hype around them. But I think Joe Dumars kind of fed that fire because he jumped the gun so early on Darko. I mean, anybody that would listen to Joe Dumars, he was saying that they were going to draft Darko Milicic. I mean, anybody. And he was doing this back in May. Back in May, when the draft, still a month away from the draft, he's sitting there saying, we're going to draft Darko Milicic. He's our guy. We're going to get him. Now, this is where I had a problem with Joe Dumars' decision to do that. First of all, it's way too early. You still got a lot of time to deliberate and think about this. And he was kind of hard-headed in a way about it. And the second thing is, he had a quote. I'm looking at here at a Yahoo Sports article that they actually sat down with Joe Dumars to talk about his decision to draft Darko. And this is kind of to kind of dive into Joe D's mindset during the time. Quote, I could give a dissertation on that. After I drafted Darko, from that point on, the amount of background we do on every single player that you see us draft is ridiculous. We do as much or more background than any other team in the NBA because of that. The background on Darko was about 20% of what we do now. I look back on it now and realize you didn't know half of the stuff you needed to know. End quote. Now, that's from a Yahoo Sports article on Joe Dumars as he reflected on that decision to draft Darko Milicic. And that's the thing. Over time now, Matt, research, I mean, I think Darko really sparked this, to be honest with you. When you see a big flop like Darko who comes into the league, all this hype around him, the Pistons draft him, and he ends up being a dud, they look back at that moment and say, wow, we really screwed up as far as our scouting goes. They look at his numbers overseas and look at how he played. He had great years over there, and their eyes immediately popped open to the point they needed to see no more from him. And they said, this is our guy. He can come in and contribute immediately. And him being a second pick, you know, after LeBron James, I mean, that alone is a star, you know, a trophy to put on the mantle right there. So all of that hype and everything had to do with the fact that the Pistons had looked at numbers and had not done conducive research into just how good Darko could have been in the NBA. That's where he screwed up there. I mean, he just said it. I mean, only 20% of what they do now was done on Darko. Right. Next thing, though, and I don't want to put this all on Joe D, just like you said, Larry Brown, let's be honest here, he didn't get his kid a fair shot. I'm not even going to lie. I remember when Darko got drafted, and there were game that would go by, and I'm sitting there saying, Darko is not getting any minutes here. I don't even know. I couldn't make an educated judgment. It's kind of like an argument I had with one of our students here on Current Sports. They tried to argue about, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on the
Gigi
Datome. Craig tries to argue with me, Caleb argued with me that Gigi's this unbelievable player. If he just gets the time, then he could really show what he can do. Well, I argue with Caleb, well, that's all fine and dandy, but I can't make an educated judgment on the kid because I haven't seen him play. And that's the thing with Darko. I said that all year. I couldn't make an educated judgment on just how good Darko could be because Larry Brown didn't give him a shot.
Right. He played 159 minutes the entire season.
Exactly. I mean, that's
2 minutes a game.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy to me. So Larry Brown, first of all, that's where it screwed up right there. And the minutes that, you know, that Darko would get, I mean, he would just really just come in the game, and you could just tell from his body language that he just didn't want to be involved with the game. I mean, he kind of felt that there was some animosity between him and the coaching staff. That, I mean, he's only getting 2 minutes a game, and he's a second overall draft pick. I mean, there's something, this doesn't add up here. And when he would come in, his effort wasn't there. He just didn't seem in tune with the game. He didn't seem like he didn't want to be in the NBA.
Right. Well, and, you know, can you think of a worse way to spend your rookie season as the number two pick than being dubbed the human victory cigar while the number one, three, four, and five picks are all averaging double figures in scoring,
right.
You know, leading their teams. You know, so he has to do that, you know, barely getting off the bench for more than 2 minutes a game while all of the guys who are drafted with him are having immediate success.
Exactly.
So I think that definitely factored in.
Right.
Now, my one thing in defense of Joe D., you know, you said he commented that they do 20% of what they do now. Mm. I think that would probably be for the entire league. Mm. I mean, you look at the state of the NBA in the early 2000s. So let's go back to the 1999 draft. Manu Ginobili is the 57th pick in the draft. Mm. Barely even gets drafted. He's starting to emerge at that point. You have the 2001 draft. Look at this top four of the 2001 draft. Kwame Brown, number one. Tyson Chandler, number two.
Yeah.
Pau Gasol, number three. And Eddie Curry, number four.
Mm-hmm.
One of those players was successful at that point in their career. Tyson Chandler came around, but it wasn't for, you know, 7 years.
Yeah, so Tyson Chandler developed into a good
Pau
player.
Pau Gasol was more or less an immediate star. I mean, he was a solid player from the get-go. So I think the trend in the NBA at that time was, if you want a skilled player right away, you have to look overseas. High school, you're not going to get a polished product out of the gate. You know, 1 year in college, you might not get the product that you want right away. If you go to Europe, you might find a guy who is more ready for a pro game, more ready to handle the pro season.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that did not happen with Darko. He was about as far from ready as you could be. But at the time, it's kind of understandable how you would sip that Kool-Aid, how you would fall for the, you know, this great European hope who you don't know much about.
Right, right, right. Exactly.
Just like everyone else in the league would. I mean, of the quotes that you read, I mean, people
they are
say,
crazy.
You know, more than Dirk, you know, who is also blowing up at that time. You know,
right.
Dirk Nowitzki, who was drafted seventh in 1998. I mean, Tony Parker, Mehmet Okur, Yao Ming goes number one in 2002. So
right.
You have all these foreign products coming in and impacting the league right away. I can see how it would be easy to fall for that and think, wow, this is a 7-foot left-hander who can shoot threes, dribble the ball, and play in the post. Yeah, we want him on our team. I can definitely see that. Not to mention, the Pistons had a lot of wings at that time. I mean, they had Rip Hamilton, they had Bob Sura, they had Tayshaun Prince, Darvin Ham,
wow,
Corliss Williamson,
I forgot about Sura.
Michael Curry. I mean,
they did.
And let's say they draft Carmelo.
Uh-huh.
Would he have been okay playing 159 minutes in an entire season under Larry Brown?
But it would have been better than Darko Milicic. Let's be honest here. But Matt,
this is
the reason, Matt, why I'm putting this at number one.
Okay.
This is the reason why, and because he didn't make your top five. He didn't make a spot in the top five at all.
I think it's too tough to fault people for drafts.
Well, this is the thing. When you look at this move, the reason why it has to be number one with me, because like you said, I mean, you kind of alluded to it. The victim of success that the rest of the players in that draft class had. I mean, you look at a guy like Dwayne Wade. I mean, Dwayne Wade was arguably, you know, definitely one of the top three players in the league at one point. Carmelo Anthony, still to this day, Carmelo Anthony, say what you want about, you know, his effort defensively. He is an offensive scoring juggernaut. I mean, one of the best scorers in the league, without a doubt. Chris Bosh. I mean, Chris Bosh is a guy who's not one of those guards, you know, one of those two guards or, you know, type of players, but he can also take you in the post and damage you down there. I thought he could have definitely been a great addition for the Pistons. But I just feel as though the Pistons were, I mean, you talk about the success, let's just look at the success of all of those players. I mean, that's unbelievable. And Joe Dumars, when you look at all of those names that were taken, and you look at Darko as number two, you sit there and you just look at it and just say, oh my gosh, I mean, what in the world was going through their head? Now, justifiably so, again, there were so many people that were so big and up on Darko that you can kind of see where Joe Dumars made his decision in that regard. At the same time, it's such a sore thumb when you look at that top 10 compared to all the rest of that class, that it's got to be number one, without a doubt, Matt. Without it, it's got to be up there.
I mean, history will paint it that way.
Without a doubt.
Definitely. But if I'm looking for a bad move that people knew was a bad move when it happened, I think it has to be the Ben Gordon, Charlie Villanueva signings in 2009. I think that is a worse move because you know what you're getting.
But some people say I have to dig in their mind to think about. I had to dig in my mind to think about that. This is one of those things that is just so out there and in your face.
It definitely is.
You hear it year after year.
I mean, Darko is a, you know, he's the dud filling in a sandwich that has Hall of Fame bread. Right. I mean, like, that's what it is.
I like that.
You know, like, he is so bad, and then it's such a stark contrast to the guys who were drafted right around him that, yeah, it definitely sticks out like a sore thumb.
Oh, yeah.
But I think at the time, you almost can't fault him because, I mean, the draft is such a weird science anyway, but the way he was being hyped up, the way that the league was trending toward European players.
But I think Joe has a lot to do with that hype, though, without a doubt. Because
it's certainly possible.
He was saying this back like 2 months before the draft. He's like, oh, Darko, he's unbelievable. We're going to take him without a doubt. There's no doubt in our mind. We don't care about the rest of the players. He was so set on Darko. He was hard-headed. I honestly think that he didn't even give Wade, Anthony, Bosch even a second look.
I mean, and at that time, he kind of had every right to be. Because every move he made, I mean, he had the Midas touch. I mean, everything he did turned to gold. I mean, let's get Chauncey Billups for next to nothing. Let's get Ben Wallace for next to nothing. I'll take Rip Hamilton for Jerry Stackhouse. And all of his moves to that point had absolutely worked out.
Yeah.
So I think for him to be a little cocky and a little headstrong makes sense. I mean, at that point, he had kind of earned it. But, yeah, I mean, it's a dark chapter. He's gonna try and block that out in his later.
And the
years,
reason, another
sure.
reason why it's number one, because I think that was the start of the demise of the Pistons right there. I think that was the start of it.
I mean, that
decision to draft Darko, and then after you realize you're not going to play him a lot and you're not going to give him minutes, why not trade him somewhere? You know what I mean? Trade him somewhere or make a move
for him.
Get something out of it. And he didn't even try to do that. That's what really grinded my gears about it. So, all right, well, let's hit the second break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little about the Red Wings, as the Red Wings have now made the playoffs, ladies and gents, and we'll have a little bit of a throwback Thursday for you. Don't go anywhere. Current Sports returns in just a sec.
On the next Fresh Air, writing the songs for Frozen, including this Academy Award winner, we talk with songwriters Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, who are married and have two children. Robert also co-created the musicals The Book of Mormon and Avenue Q. Join us. Let the storm
rage on. That's Fresh Air, coming up at 3 o'clock. Welcome back to Current Sports. I am your host, Al Martin, joined by Matt Luckey. Matt, just real briefly, let's go, because we only got about 8 minutes left or 7 minutes left in the show. Let's go to Throwback Thursday really quick. What happened on this Thursday in the sports world?
All right, well, a lot of Masters championships have been decided, but
I'm sure.
I'm going to leave those out, except for one, because, you know, if you do a couple of them, you have to do them all, and I don't want to leave anybody out. But we'll go to 1913. Walter Johnson begins a string of 56 consecutive scoreless innings. That's pretty impressive.
That is.
1916, the first professional golf tournament is held, and the PGA is created in New York City. So a big, big day for golf, definitely. Mm-hmm. 1934, the Blackhawks defeat the Red Wings 1-0 to win the Stanley Cup. A rough day in Detroit sports history, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
1947, Brooklyn Dodgers president Branch Rickey announced that he had purchased the contract of the one, the only Jackie Robinson from the Montreal Royals.
Wow.
Robinson was the first African-American player of the modern era.
Yeah.
Next up, we have more sadness for Detroit. The Syracuse Nats defeat the Fort Wayne Pistons 4-3 to win the NBA championship. In 1956, the Montreal Canadiens defeat the Red Wings 4-1 to win the Stanley Cup. So a close but no cigar for Detroit teams. In 1961, Gary Player of South Africa became the first foreign golfer to win the Masters in Augusta, Georgia. I will include that because, you know, he broke some barriers there.
Yeah,
in 1990, Dave Taylor, Thomas Sandstrom, and Tony Granato scored 3 goals each as the LA Kings beat the Calgary Flames 12-4 to record the first 3-player hat trick in one game in NHL history.
Hey, what was the score?
12-4.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
Rough night for the goaltender there for the Flames. 1993, the Pittsburgh Penguins extend their NHL consecutive game winning streak to 17 with a 4-2 win over the New York Rangers. That record still stands. In 1993, also, the Ottawa Senators win their first road game against the Islanders after 38 straight losses. Yikes.
That hurts.
That's
just
a whole
to hear that.
Season's worth of losses on the road.
Oh.
1995, Andre Agassi finally breaks through to the ATP Tour number one ranking in the world, ending Pete Sampras's 101-week stay at the top.
I used to love Agassi, man.
He's a great player.
He's great.
I miss him. And last and pretty much most certainly least, the Chicago Bulls in 1999 set an NBA record for ineptitude, being held to a record 49 points in an 82-49 defeat against the Miami Heat.
Oh, my gosh.
They didn't even break 50.
Did not even break 50. My goodness.
That was the year after MJ retired.
Wow.
Or MJ, well, yeah, I guess he did retire. He would come back later with
the first
with the
time,
Wiz,
right?
But yeah.
Right. Gotcha. Oh, my goodness, man.
Rough stuff.
Yeah, that is rough stuff. Oh, my goodness. I see here in 2002, King Griffey Jr., he became the youngest player in baseball history to reach 400 home runs. He was 30 years old, 141 days.
But then, of course, A-Rod would break that.
Exactly. A-Rod.
Thanks a lot, A-Rod.
Yep. A-Rod, I tell you, boy.
Ruin everything.
Always. All the time. So, all right. Throwback Thursday for you folks. Again, we have about 5 minutes left in the show. Some great news here for any Detroit sports fan in general, as this coveted streak, one of the most coveted streaks in North American sports history, the Red Wings, even though they lost last night to Pittsburgh, they did notch the 1 point they needed to clinch a playoff spot for the 23rd consecutive season. Unbelievable stuff. They are tied with Columbus in the wild card standings, but both clubs have clinched spots in the postseason. Great stuff. I remember we talked about this on the show a few weeks ago, Matt. I think you, Alex, and I agreed that the Wings would, you know, eventually make the playoffs. And it was just about clicking at the right time and getting healthy at the right time. I think this team, has definitely been battered up. We talked about that countless times. And, I kind of agree with Mike Babcock. I mean, I believe this team, when healthy, even when 80% healthy, this team can beat anybody out there. They can play with anybody out there. And they showed that down the stretch of this season, even though they were still dealing with some lingering injuries, here left and right. I mean, it was great that they have Datsu back now. And looking at Nyquist, how he's been playing crazy, insane, good. But this team, when healthy, when relatively healthy, they can compete with anybody. And I was just good that they're in the dance now, because now anything can happen. I think the Wings, I think they're going to turn a lot of heads on exactly how far they get in this year's playoffs.
I agree. And like you said, once you get in the playoffs, it's a whole different ballgame. And it might be especially so for the Red Wings because, hey, there are no shootouts in the playoffs.
Right.
So
that's good.
Say goodbye to those 15 shootout losses, because that's not going to happen in the playoffs.
Yeah.
The streak might be the most impressive in professional sports, just in terms of the consistency over two decades is insane. A little graphic here. The Red Wings playoff streak is older than 13 NHL teams.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
They
older than franchises.
Older than franchises. The Senators, the Predators, the Avalanche, the Jets, the Hurricanes, the Lightning, the Panthers, the Ducks, the Sharks, the Wild, the Blue Jackets, the Stars, and the Coyotes. Those teams didn't even exist when the Red Wings last missed the playoffs. That's just...
Yeah. That's
insane.
Crazy when you think about that.
I mean, hats off to the Ilitch family, to Ken Holland. It's unbelievable. It's Detroit, and I think the hockey world takes it for granted because it's a given.
Because you
gonna
expect
make the
them.
Playoffs.
We talked about that.
Absolutely.
We talked about the inevitable with this team. Even though they were struggling throughout the season, we're sitting there saying we just can't fathom.
I mean, we haven't been alive.
Right? We haven't. Not
like,
at all.
This
streak is as old as I
cannot imagine a time the Red Wings missed the playoffs, because it hasn't happened in my lifetime.
Not at
all.
That's
crazy.
That is crazy. And you know what? I hope it does continue. But, this is great for the city of Detroit, too, because looking at, you've been watching the Pistons all year, and they're not making the playoffs. And the Tigers are just starting their season, so there's no postseason action yet when it comes to them. But to have some postseason action happen now in this city of Detroit, where, the environment of the postseason, there's nothing like it in sports. And there's nothing like playoff hockey, I hear, at a game. I've never been to a playoff hockey game. I want to go. It's on my bucket list this year, so I hopefully I can attend at least one playoff game this year for the Wings. I know that's certainly a hot ticket, but man, it's just good for the city right now to have some team in the postseason. So can't wait for it. And you know, like I said, it was inevitable for this team. You know, this team, they, like I said, they just clicked at the right time at the right moment, and it's going to be a joy to watch them in the playoffs now. So
yeah, no team in the NHL wants to play the Red Wings in the playoffs.
No, not at all. They're so dangerous, so dangerous. All right, well, unfortunately, we are out of time here on WKR's Current Sports. Again, you can be a part of our panel this evening as Steve Smith, of course, such a huge contributor to the MSU men's basketball program, who will have a great NBA career. He'll be hosting a panel of fellow journalists who have covered the Olympic Games. That's the theme tonight. If you want to be a part of that live audience, go to WKR.org. I believe there is a few seats still available, so do that right now. All right, thanks so much to all of you for tuning in today's Current Sports. You've been listening to Current Sports with me, Al Martin, of WKRE's Lansing. As always, take care, have one fantastic Thursday, and be easy, people.